doing the very thing you saw one of them just doing. And we could have services all month and probably never repeat a young person and never use anybody over the age of 25 if we wanted to. And that's a real blessing, a real blessing. We're dealing with the topic of Gnosticism, and we spent a couple of days looking at various elements of it. And I put up an overhead toward the end of our session yesterday, and I'm just going to put it back up. I don't know that anybody needs to still be copying it. There were some copies of it made, but for those of you that haven't been with us or might be a refresher for some of your memories, it's a pretty good, I won't say it's a complete, but it's a pretty good recap of some of the major aspects of Gnosticism. Thank you, Marvin. Well, yeah. Thank you, Marvin and Rick. We could make some snide comment about Vandalia, but we'll just let that go. Whoa, you're not from there, just calm down. You're not from there, just calm down. Thank you. Why some species eat their young. We'll talk about family issues next week. So will I. Okay, on to Gnosticism. This is a recap of some of the elements that we talked about. But basically, for those of you, as a recap, and for those of you that haven't been with us, it's a concept that relies heavily on self-knowledge of oneself rather than on knowledge of God. Salvation comes from knowing oneself. Salvation comes from intuitive experience rather than from revealed Word of God. Man reaches his zenith by looking within rather than looking above. And I don't want to belabor that point, but I did want to list that up there. And if you want that, we'll get you some copies of that. We made about 50, and I think they've gone, but it's easy to make more copies. I want to put another overhead up, if I dare. Let me just hand this to Rick so that I don't have to discombobulate. But this is a similar recap, but it's in a little different form. But it lists five or six elements that kind of are an outgrowth of this. And just very briefly, one of some of the characteristics of this philosophy is that man is co-substantial with God. In other words, man and God are really co-elements. And inside man is an element of God that if he can get to know it, and flame that spark enough, he literally becomes divine. And that explains why a Gnostic would look within for God rather than above. There is an element of elitism because a Gnostic believes he's someone who is wise enough and sensitive enough and had appropriate experiences enough so that he can find himself. And some people just aren't smart enough to do that. There's an element of experimental or intuitiveness. Truth comes from experience rather than from divine revealed word. There's the element of self-knowledge. I think I've already commented on that. There's a redefinition of the new birth. In other words, salvation from separation from God and salvation from elements of evil come through self-knowledge rather than coming from the finding of the Savior, Jesus Christ. And lastly, there's the element of divinity. To a Gnostic, the mystery of God has already been revealed long before the birth of Jesus Christ and even before scriptures were written. You remember in scriptures, Paul says, now the mystery has been revealed. A Gnostic would think it's already been revealed. It's simply hidden and buried within a man. And therefore, the incarnation, the crucifixion, and the subsequent resurrection of Jesus Christ really have no bearing in Gnostic thinking in terms of redemption, because it's all inside of us if we can simply be wise enough to find it and to address it. Okay. Any questions on anything I've covered? Probably not today, but in the last couple of days, before we begin looking at a section of passage found in the Gospel of John. I want to spend most of our time today on an exegesis of the first 18 verses of the Gospel of John. But I'll pause if there's questions you would like to consider. Okay, then you might, as many of you already are, head toward the Gospel of John. The first 18 verses, and I know these are familiar to you, but I want to go back and take a little look at them in light of our evaluation of Gnosticism and see if maybe now they don't mean just a little more to us. And maybe for a few that haven't studied them in great detail, it can be a real appropriate experience. The two major writers in the New Testament, well, let me ask that. Who wrote the most books in the New Testament? How many? 14 is my answer. You might quibble on one. Who would be second? John, who wrote 5. Now, they didn't necessarily write the most words, but they wrote the most epistles and the most books. John was probably the latest of the writers, or among the latest of the writers. Paul was probably among the earliest. Now, we know that Paul dealt in some of his writings with combating the false teaching of Judaism. And you remember the bullseye I drew up here the first day from Acts chapter 1, verse 8, Jerusalem, then Judea, then all the Gentilic world. Well, as the gospel evolved out, Judaism became the predominant teaching that the apostles seemed to have to bear with, and therefore the book of Galatians in particular has a lot to do with combating Judaism. But as the church matured and we get into some of Paul's later writings and into some of the writings of John, the second predominant false teaching begins to be combated in earnest, and that was Gnosticism. We're going to look at John's writings first and take a look at some of these passages in detail, and then we'll take a look possibly at some of Paul's comments in the book of Colossians as time permits. The Gospel of John, I believe, was written for primarily two purposes. One was evangelistic and the other was apologetic. By evangelistic, I suspect you know what I mean. John, in the 20th chapter and in the 30 and 31st verses, he says, I write these things so that you may believe. One of John's objectives was to spread the gospel and make believers. That's evangelism. But underlying that, I think there was a mission of apologetics. And by apologetics, for those of you that may not be familiar with that term in religious connotation, it doesn't mean John was apologizing for what he believes. It's a word that means he was defending what he believed. And he was defending it against this doctrine of Gnosticism. And so as we go through these passages, I want us to go through them with the eye peeled toward what's John trying to say to us in light of Gnosticism. You know, it's amazing how illiterate many people are about the Bible. I recently was told about a quiz that was given, and one of the questions on the quiz was, what was Golgotha? The number one answer that was given as to what was Golgotha, it was the name of the giant that David killed. Now, we think that's silly. Well, it's wrong, but it just kind of points out the real lack of biblical knowledge that most people have. And therefore, we've got in many minds and in many churches and many religious organizations very, very fertile ground. Now, if I were to ask you the question, who was Jesus of Nazareth? Most of you would probably get that right by saying something along the line, he is the Son of God. Now, I'd like for you in the margin of your notebook or on the back of a page, I'd like for you just to take about 60 seconds and write three things that you would use to prove that. Jesus is the Son of God. Just very bullet form. Three things that you would use to prove that to somebody. You've got the right answer. My question is, can you prove it? Or how would you prove it? Give me another 15 seconds. Five. Okay. Someone want to share one of the things you wrote down? How would you go about convincing somebody of that Jesus is the Son of God? Well, what's that? And how would you use that to prove to me that he's the Son of God if I don't believe it? Okay, I'm sure there's a proof in there somewhere. John? I'm sorry? Okay, how would that be a proof, Paul? Okay, when God spoke, this is my beloved son. Very good. John? Okay, go back and take an historical approach to proving it. The resurrection. Okay, very good. I'll take one more, Lee. Transfiguration. Okay, all of those are good. Are good answers. I just simply wanted us to stop and think a little bit, because I believe in these first 18 verses of John chapter 1, John's going to give us four reasons why he believes that Jesus is the Son of God. The whole book of John is written for one purpose, and that is to put forth the case that Jesus is the Son of God. Now, that's important for the early church, but I think it was extremely important because the primary heresy that they were having to deal with was founded on the fact that Jesus wasn't God. So John writes this extensive gospel with the primary purpose of proving that Jesus is God. Now, how does John go about proving that? Well, let me share with you a couple of things that I think he does. First of all, I think he presents miracles that Jesus did to prove it. He presents claims that state Jesus was divine, and he presents events. Rick, if you would be so kind. This is a list of the eight miracles in the Gospel of John. And on your notebook, I gave you a place to write these down. Eight miracles. Seven of them are pre-resurrection, and one of them is post-resurrection. the turning of water to wine, the healing of the boy in chapter 4, the healing of the lame man in chapter 5, verses 1 to 18, the feeding of the multitude, chapter 6, verse 1 through 15, walking on water, chapter 6, verse 16 and following, the healing of the blind man, chapter 9, the raising of Lazarus, chapter 11, and then the miraculous catch of the fish after the resurrection in chapter 21, the first 8 verses. And I read those not for your benefit, but for benefit of the tape. But all 8 of those were done with the express purpose of showing that Jesus Christ is divine and is God. And that's why in the passage that Tom took us back to, these signs I write unto you so that you may believe. Believe what? Believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Now this won't interfere with what you're copying down. I'll do this. That's not fair to ask you to do that. Now on this one, you've got that same list on the left hand. I've just added a right hand list. You've got the same list on the right hand, or left hand, and then we'll talk about the list on the right hand for just very briefly. The left hand list are the signs, the miracles in the Gospel of John pointing toward the deity of Christ. The list on the right hand are the claims of Jesus that point toward his deity. I'll give you just a couple of minutes. A few of you are still writing, and I appreciate that, and I don't want to jump ahead. Don't worry about the right hand too much yet. When you get the left hand done, we'll talk a little bit about it. I know that's not going to happen. You're going to keep writing, those of you that are writing, but that's okay. It's appreciated. We talked about this in 1994, and in fact, I spent about a week and a half on it, and I'm just going to touch on it this time. The list on the right are the 7 predicated I am sayings. 7 different times Jesus says, I am, with a different predicate in the Gospel of John. He says, I am the bread, chapter 6. I am the light, chapter 8. I am the door, chapter 10. I am the good shepherd, chapter 10. I am the resurrection and the life, chapter 11. I am the way, the truth, and the life, chapter 14. And I am the true vine. Those are called commonly the 7 predicated I ams in the Gospel of John. And I can't prove this, but you know your Bible well enough to know that 7 is the number of completeness. So it strikes me that it's probably no coincidence that Jesus gives us 7 predicated I ams. In the Greek, it's ego eimi. I am. Now, think back to the Old Testament. Where was the origin of this claim, I am? The burning bush, Exodus chapter 3, verse 14. Moses said, who am I going to say sent you? And he says, well, I am that I am. Now, that sounds like convoluted, kind of gibberish. I mean, give me a straight answer. Moses says, what do I tell them? Well, just tell them I am that I am. Now, let me comment on that for just a moment. Some of you are still writing. There's probably more than two, but I want to make 2 significant comments about God's answer back in Exodus chapter 3, verse 19. First of all, that's as good an answer as he could get, because who do you compare God to? You know, when I ask you what something is like, you're going to answer that by comparing it to something that we both know. If I ask you, what does a banana taste like? You're going to have a hard time telling me that, except using a banana in the sentence. So when we describe things, we tend to describe them based upon something that's like them, but there is nothing like God. So God's saying, I'm like I am. I am that I am. That's point number one. Point number two is, notice the tense of that. I am, present tense. This is an extremely important concept when we're talking about deity. Deity is always in the present tense. Deity is always in the present tense. Because God and deity are not affected by time. Now, I can say this, but I'm not going to try to fool you and tell you I totally understand it or can grasp it. Because we talk about what happened yesterday and what might happen tomorrow. I believe for God, everything is happening at the same time. I used to say things like, when I get to heaven, I'm going to ask God what it was like to hang on the cross. I think that it's very possible, not only if when we get to heaven can we ask that, we may be able to experience that with them to the extent that we, to the extent we're godlike, everything is in the present. Now, I don't know how far to take that, and I've taken it as far as I can explain it. But time is a man element, not a God element. So Jesus had to say, I am, just like God in Exodus 3 had to say, I am that I am. So in the Gospel of John, Jesus doesn't say, I was the bread, or I will be the bread. He simply says, I am. Now, when the Jews heard the words, I am, ego eimi, they immediately had their minds go back to what we call Exodus chapter 3, verse 14. There was no question, I don't believe, in their mind that he was saying, I am the Son of God. John uses signs and claims all throughout his book to manifest the deity of Jesus Christ. Now let's go back to John chapter 1 and begin to do a little more detailed exegesis of this passage. I wondered whether to do this or not, because I know to some extent you're familiar with it, but there is just so much in here. In the first 18 verses of the Gospel of John, there are two main characters, Jesus and John the Baptist. We're not going to deal with John the Baptist, that's not our topic, but we are going to be dealing with Jesus. And about 15 of these 18 verses deal with Jesus. But I want you to notice that this passage follows a progression. Can you shut that off for just a moment, Rick? Thank you. The passage that we're going to be looking at follows a progression. And it's a little bit like a funnel. And the progression is going to be with starting with eternity and taking us down to the incarnation. And in the middle of this progression, John's going to talk about the creation. Well, you can see right now, just by those words that I put on the board in our discussion for the last couple of days, that this one would be extremely important if you're trying to combat Gnostic heresy, and this one will be extremely important in trying to combat Gnostic heresy, and everything begins with eternity. John chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, take us back into eternity. And they're going to bring us in just a few short verses up to where the eternal God became man. In the beginning was the Word, the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the same was in the beginning with God. Now the Word, just so we make sure we all are on the same page, is a reference to Jesus Christ. If you look down at verse 14, it says the Word was made flesh. That's John's reference to the incarnation. But he's beginning with the concept of the Word was in the beginning. Now the word Word is used different ways in the Scripture. In the Old Testament, in Psalms 33 and 6, the Word is referred to as an agent of creation. In Hosea chapter 1, verse 2, the Word is referenced to God's message. In Psalms 119 and 11, the Word is referenced to God's law. But in Greek philosophy, in Greek thought, the Logos, or the Word, referred to the divine essence that holds all things together. The divine reason behind minds and even wisdom. It was a word that was extensively used by Plato, even prior to John's using it here in his writing. Now, when the Jews heard this, that the Word was God, they considered that to be blasphemous. When the Greeks heard that the claim that the Word became flesh, they considered that to be unthinkable because of their Gnostic influence. But when John explains it here in the first few verses of this book, he's trying to bring a new understanding to this concept of the Word, that the Word was the Son of God, God incarnate or in the flesh. The Greek construction of this first verse is really indicating that this Word has all of the essence, all of the attributes of deity. Jesus the Messiah was fully God. That's what John's saying in this first verse, without any question. And even in his incarnation, when he emptied himself, he was still fully man and fully God. Now, my mind and your mind isn't able to comprehend how something can be 100% of two things. But Jesus was 100% man and 100% God. He says the Word was not created. Therefore, the Word had to be the ultimate God. John was using this concept of the Word not as an arbitrary use, but a use that had tremendous theological ramifications. Now, someone mentioned, and I don't remember who it was, but we mentioned at least one of the religious sects that doesn't hold to the belief that Jesus was divine, and that was the Jehovah's Witnesses. And in their translation of this verse, as it was pointed out the other day, they translate the last phrase, and the Word was a God, adding the word a and using a small g. Because there's no way you can take John verse 1 without changing it and deny the deity of Christ. But we're dealing with time here. A.W. Tozer made a comment about time that I thought was rather interesting, and I'll share just this little bit with you. He said, "The mind looks backward into time until the dim past vanishes, then turns and looks into the future until thought and imagination collapse in exhaustion. And God is at both ends, unaffected by either. Because time marks the time created existence, and because God never began to exist, time has absolutely no application to him. Begin is a time word, and can have no personal meaning to the higher and loftier God who inhabits eternity." So John's beginning with eternity, and now he's going to bring us through a progression. He's going to bring us through a progression and bring us up to the incarnation. Let's look at verse 3, and then I'll pause for some comments. All things were made by him, and was not, and without him was not anything made that was made. Now you remember the Gnostic model for creation? How it came about by a demagogue? It was a cosmic goof. John here is saying the Word is the true God. And now in verse 3 he's going to say, and everything was made by him. Now verse 3 carries two important aspects in terms of the refutation of Gnosticism. Number one, since the Word made it all, then it wasn't created, so it had to be God. And since God, the Word, created it, then it was not a mistake. It was well organized, and it was well thought out. Another passage, and we may get to it today, I don't know. Colossians chapter 1, verses 16 and 17 also reiterate that Jesus created and made all things. Well, let's turn over and read that. It's such an important passage. Colossians chapter 1. Paul, I think, is combating some of the same thought processes or difficulties. By him were all things created that are in heaven and that are in earth, visible and invisible, whether they be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created by him and for him. That's a verse that's worth underlining or imprinting very diligently on your memory. If all things were created by him, then he can't be a created being. And if he's not a created being, then by definition he has to be God. And that's John's argument. I believe the first proof that John gives to his readers that Jesus is the Son of God is, number one, Jesus is eternal. Jesus is eternal. If you're back in the book of John, turn to John chapter 8, verse 58. It's almost another I am saying, but it really points out this concept of eternity. He's talking to the Jews about their father Abraham. And in John 8, 58, Jesus says unto them, verily, verily, I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am. Now that's awkward grammar. If you're an English teacher, you would probably want that to say, before Abraham was, I was. And that would be proper English, but the problem is it wouldn't be proper theology. Because divinity, the Godhead, is always in present tense. There is no past or future. So Jesus simply had to say, before Abraham was, I am. Abraham was because he was man, and man has a time element. Jesus is God, and he doesn't have that time element, so he has to be in the present tense. You could take that one single verse and use that as a proof text of the divinity of Jesus Christ if you didn't want to use anything else, because otherwise that sentence makes absolutely no difference. Before Abraham was, I am. Even I know better than to speak like that. But I believe that's exactly what Jesus was referring to there. So number one, I hate to move. It's going to fall off. But number one, proof, Jesus was eternal. Let me pause and see if you have any comments or questions. I don't think anybody here disagrees with that. I just want to make sure we get this out of this passage and we understand maybe why
John was presenting it as he did. Dean. I'm going to say that more than once. Thank you, Dean. It'll be one of the few times I'll thank you, but thank you. Yeah, that's the way we think. It is. And seriously, thank you for pointing it out. We can grasp it, but we can't grasp it. But I hope you grasp it. Okay? Dwayne?
It seems to me like John using the term logos in its meaning as the Greek used it to mean the rational thought, I'm not sure I can express it, of God. That is an even stronger statement that it comes across in our English translation. That truly is the God that created all things.
Okay. That was a statement, wasn't it?
Yes.
Okay, I didn't think there was a question.
No, it wasn't a question.
Yeah, I thought it was a statement. Thank you. John?
I appreciate your emphasis on the idea of God versus time. It seems like there's a lot of discouragement that comes when we accept Christ and then we walk down the road a few steps and stumble and think that perhaps with the Christ we were letting down, when in fact he knows exactly who we are.
Sure. We can let God down, we just can't surprise him. We can let him down, we just can't surprise him. And we do it all the time, letting him down. But we don't surprise him. I don't think God's ever been surprised. Even when it says it repented that he made man, he knew it was going to happen. He knew it was going to happen. Steve? Yes. Okay. Sure. He's involved in holding it together. Absolutely. Quite contrary to maybe a deistic approach to it. He is involved even in the natural processes. Very good. Thank you. Laura?
In verse 1, in the beginning, that refers to our beginning, not God.
Well, that's one way to look at it. I'll give you another way to look at it. And I had this in my notes, and I just got to find it, because I didn't touch on that. Some people take that as an indication that this refers to our beginning, but in the Greek, and I have to go by memory here, the word "the" isn't there. So there are some Greek translators that would translate that in the eternal expanse before the beginning, the word was, and take it as a reference to eternity rather than to a reference to our beginning. I think a more strict translation of that probably could be rendered in the infinite expanse before time began. So in the beginning may not be the absolute best translation of that phrase. And I tend to lean toward that, although I'm not dogmatic. Do you understand what I said? Okay. Well, we're talking about eternity, so that gets a little bit tough. In the beginning was the Word. And here again, you've got that word "was" referencing a timeless entity. So it's probably written this way so you and I can begin to grasp it a little bit. But he was prior to the beginning of time as we know it. I think we can say that for sure, and I would agree with your statement there. No. No. He was, by definition, If he created everything, prior to him creating, he was all there was. That's why yesterday I said, at one point in time, technically, pantheism was correct. Pantheism means that God is in everything. Well, before the creation, God was in everything because God was all there was. But God's not in all of his creation. I mean, you don't find God in trees and animals. Excellent questions, excellent comments. It's just when we start talking about eternity and God, our curiosity exceeds our capacity to grasp. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't question and probe and learn. Jay? Sure. Yes, absolutely. And they're not the only ones. They're just one of the more successful organizations in terms of growth. They're one of the more successful organizations that take those positions. Anybody else? Question or comment? Okay, now look at verse 4. In him is life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. Reason number 3 that John gives us, that Jesus is the Son of God. He is the giver of spiritual life. In him was life, and the life was the light of the men, and the light shineth in darkness. We're talking, I believe, here about spiritual life, because not all men comprehended it. So we see the progression from eternity to creation, now to the giver of life. Now when we get to verse 5, John begins, and I just read it, his own form of dualism. Remember, Gnostic dualism was matter and spirit. John now introduces his dualism, or the Holy Spirit's dualism here, of light and darkness. And that's a wonderful study. We won't have time to do it, but a study of how John uses in his writings this dualism of light and darkness. The Gnostic thought it was matter versus spirit. John says, no, the battle is spiritual, not physical. It's light and darkness. Now let's drop down to verse 9, because we've got a few verses in here that refer to John the Baptist, but I want to drop down to verse 9 to continue our thoughts on the Son. This was the true light that lighteth every man that cometh into the world. Jesus was the true light. Now, think of this from a Gnostic standpoint, how important this was. John is saying Jesus is the true light, and he's coming into the world, and every man is enlightened through Jesus Christ. Now that's totally contrary to the Gnostic heresy that man has God within him and is enlightened from within. John says, no, you're not enlightened from within. You're enlightened because of Jesus Christ. Universalism might say all men are the light. Christianity says all men can have the light. But there's a big difference between all men having light and all men being able to have light. Verse 10, he was in the world, and the world was made by him, and the world knew him not. Now we're coming down to the incarnation. Verse 1 dealt with eternity. Verse 3 dealt with creation. Now verse 10, we're to earth, or to the world. And the very thing that Jesus has created now is going to reject him. And we're to what's called the doctrine of incarnation. And I think you all understand what the word incarnation means. But just a quick way to explain this to people so they'll understand it is have them think about chili con carne. Chili con carne is chili with flesh. That's what con carne means. So incarnation is simply in or with the flesh. And all the incarnation is God with flesh. I say all it is, it's a miracle. But that's a quick way to explain it to people and an easy way maybe for us to try to be able to understand it. But the wonderful thing here is God didn't just tell us that his Son existed. He showed us that his Son existed. And that's the incarnation. And we talked yesterday about how Jesus is still that man. Acts chapter 17, verse 31, and a couple of other passages were passed out. So Jesus is still a man. He's a spiritual man, but he's still a man. I believe Jesus is different now than he was before he came, because he has that element of empathy that comes from his humanity and his manhood. Verse 11, he came unto his own, and his own received him not. But as many as received him, he gave them power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name. Now, what would a Gnostic think of verse 12? He'd say, that's not right. The power to become a son of God is in me. A Gnostic would say, John says, no, the power to become a son of God comes from receiving Jesus Christ. Right out of the chute, John is taking this heresy head on. And more than maybe we can fully appreciate is just verse by verse by verse disarming it. Now, did everyone believe what he said? No, but in a logical, methodical sense, these 18 verses are John's disarming, tearing apart, whatever you want to call it, the heresy that was threatening the church. Verse 13, which were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. Now just think. A Gnostic says, I have become God by knowing myself. It's my will. It's my application of my mind where I get to know myself, my inner self. And here John says, it's not by the will of man, it's but the will of God. The only way you become right with God is through the grace of God, as we discussed this morning in Richard's class. And then verse 14 that you know so well, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, and the glory is of the only begotten Son, only begotten Father, full of grace and truth. Now, I want to just comment very briefly on this concept of grace, and Richard may comment on it more. I suspect he will. And he'd probably do it in better shape. But there seems to me there are two levels of grace. There's what's called common grace, and there's what I would call salvational grace. All men experience common grace. Yesterday was a beautiful day. The sun was shining. That was the grace of God. And as Scripture says, that it rains on the just and the unjust. All men experience that element of common grace, but only those who receive Christ have access or take advantage of salvational grace. And that's the grace that redeems us, justifies us when we receive it in obedience. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 14, it says, the gospel was for all men. That's common grace. But not all men receive it. Only some of them tap into it as salvational grace. One of the interesting things about these verses too, is when it talks about Jesus giving us life, life can only beget itself. And Jeremy talked a little bit about this Sunday morning in evolution. You know, a kind reproduces its kind, but it can't reproduce something that's not its kind. So when Jesus gives us spiritual life, then we have that element of spiritual life, of eternity that he has, but it has to come from him. It can't come from within. Colossians chapter 2, verse 9. I want to point that out as I'm going through this. It talks about the completeness of Jesus. There's a phrase there that I particularly like. Colossians chapter 2, verse 9. For in him dwelleth all the fullness of the Godhead bodily. In him dwelleth the completeness of the Godhead. He's not a ninth generation emanation. He is the complete Godhead. Now, you and I believe that with all our hearts. That's not the purpose of this. The purpose of this is to give us a little sense of how we might talk to people when we come across them that have differing views of this. The fourth reason that I think John gives us is found in verse 18, in that God has declared himself through Jesus. If you look at verse 18 of John chapter 1, no man has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him. In other words, the declaration of God to us was done through Jesus Christ. And when you know Jesus, when you receive Jesus, then you receive the Godhead. Then you receive the Father. Remember, Jesus said, if you know me, you know the Father. If you don't know me, you don't know the Father. Those were indications and full-fledged claims that Jesus was the Son of God. Now again, I don't expect that you didn't believe this before we started. I just wanted to take a little time and go back through these passages and verses and look at them through maybe what John and the early church was having to combat, of how as you go through and reread these verses, it totally disarms and takes on head-on all of these arguments that we found relative to Gnosticism so far. Let me pause and see if you have any questions or comments before we turn and go a slightly different way. Okay, let me find what I wanted. C.S. Lewis, who was a British philosopher, spent for quite some time trying to disprove the deity of Christ. And I thought I'd just share this one passage from one of his writings. As many of, if not all of you know, as he studied this, he came to the conclusion that Jesus truly was the Son of God. And he wrote, as he looked back on this, the following. I've spent many years in the futile attempt to disprove the deity of Christ. He said, you can shut Jesus up for a fool, you can spit at him, you can kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come up with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He hasn't left that open to us. He did not intend to. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He'd be a lunatic on the level with a man who says he's a poached egg. Or he'd be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either he's the Son of God, or a madman, or something worse. You must make your choice. And I thought that was pretty good. It's simply something that each one of us has to come to grips with. And I think most people here have. But a lot of people we talk to really struggle with this concept of could Jesus be actually God? And how could God exist in the flesh? I'll pause again for any comments or questions. Okay, put that one on, please. You might move that down. This was handed to me today. It wasn't part of my intended presentation, but I thought it was pretty good. And some of these points, this was taken from a book, and I haven't had a chance to read the book, so I'm not going to tell you whether I recommend the book, but I thought there were some interesting points on this. It was a book that reviews some of the modern trends in religion today. And as I scanned down it and I talked with this person about it, it just struck me that a lot of these points have these elements of Gnosticism in it that we've been talking about. For instance, number one, most postmodernists aren't against religion per se. They're against religious teachings that hold to objective truth and useful reasoning. In other words, they're not opposed to believing in God, but they have to come to grips with somehow of making the scriptures irrelevant so we don't have to adhere to them. Postmodernism lends intellectual respectability to views and practices that used to be considered superstitious and weird. That's exactly what the New Age movement is doing. And it's exactly what many of the strands of Gnosticism are doing. Verse number three I really like. Postmodernism worshipers are like postmodern readers. They are the source of truth rather than the discoverers of truth. Now that could come right out of a Gnostic text. Gnostics are the source of truth rather than discoverers of truth, because truth is in me and I just have to flame it, as opposed to truth is here and I have to dig and find it. Number five, I'm gonna save that one for tomorrow, because that's tomorrow's, but I've already given you an inkling of how I think that in. And the final analysis, truth is whatever agrees with feminism. That might be a little cruel, but it certainly has a Gnostic element to it. And I'll just let you kind of read down through a few of these. Number seven, a church that abandons God's moral revelation has nothing to offer a lost culture. That's true, but a church that abandons God's moral revelation is going to be awfully popular in this culture. Most Protestant churches in Lee Summit do not believe the entire Bible is inspired. That's a fact. Most of them do not believe the entire Bible is inspired. And the problem with that is when you start taking this verse out, as Rick put on for instrumental music yesterday, where does that slide stop? Where do you stop it? It's either God's inspired word or it isn't. It's not 90% his inspired word and 10% not. You might move that up just a little bit. If that's probably pretty... That's all right. I just wanted to get this bottom one. Number 12, according to postmodernism, laws aren't right or wrong. Law is whatever a society's most powerful group makes it. Relativism. Without a foundation of truth, therapy or getting better is paralyzed. Moving ahead to a better way of living requires a value judgment. And that may explain why many people aren't moving ahead to a better way of living. Number 10, apart from objective absolute truth, prejudice and persecution are no longer wrong, nor is anything else. When you make yourself the God, you make the rules, is the bottom line. And that's one of the great appeals to idolatry. And to a great extent, Gnosticism is simply idolatry that makes ourselves the idol. It was apparently a tremendously difficult thing for the early church to combat, because it was the philosophy of the elite, the philosophy of the intelligentsia. We might say in our lingo it was the philosophy of the liberal media. I'll put whatever phrase you want on that. I don't want to get political, but... There is an elitism that goes along with this type of thinking, and if you don't agree with it, you're made to seem very inappropriate and very archaic. Young people, when you go to college or when you get into groups that discuss various things like this, one of the great or one of the more devastating things that will be thrown at you is the fact that you're simply ignorant if you accept biblical principles and you're not enlightened. That's true of the rest of us, but it's tremendously hard for young people. I remember sitting in religious classes in college, and I was scared to say anything because I knew I'd be laughed at. So I didn't. I just took my B and ran. I don't know that that was right or wrong. I just know that's what I did. That's what I did. Comments or questions before we break? Okay, this has been a little bit more tedious than some of it, but tomorrow I do want to get into the feminist movement and some of the modern applications of Gnosticism. You got 15 minutes. Thank you. Gnosticism. I'd like to spend the majority of our time these last few days, or last 2 days that I have for this topic, looking at it as it appears to me in various realms of our society to affect us. But before I make that journey, I'd like to go back and repeat the two quotes that I opened with Monday morning by the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber. The true enemy of faith is not atheism, the claim that there is no God, but Gnosticism, the claim that God is known. The spiritual power of Gnosis, masquerading under the cloak of religion, threatens more than any other power the insight into religious reality. Hopefully, you have a better appreciation for what he meant than you did when we began this work this week. Teaching any class, for me, and especially a topic that maybe not everyone is familiar with, has a little trepidation built into it. You look out over the audience and you feel like you're throwing logs on a frozen pond and you're not sure any of it's sinking in. And then a few things happen to let you know that it is. Yesterday afternoon, a couple of things happened that made me feel that the pond was thawing a little bit and it was starting to sink in. I made toward the end of my class yesterday a comment that I thought that particular session had been a little tedious. But I had a young teenage girl come up to me and said, "Today it finally started to make sense to me." I had another one come up to me, and I'm going to share with you what she shared. She shared with me a portion of a book she's reading, and she said before this week began, she didn't give it a second thought, but now as she reflects upon that reading, she sees Gnosticism woven all throughout it. And the book she's reading is the trilogy, Star Trek, Deep Space Nine, Millennium. And some of you under 25 have probably read that book. So I asked her to write down a little portion from it that struck her as Gnostic in its annotations. And I'm just going to read this. The story is an excellent example of Gnosticism in our everyday lives, in what we read for recreation. The story revolves around a legend of the creation of the universe. According to the legend, the gods or the prophets were fighting. During one of these fights, some of the prophets' creations fell out of the temple by accident. Naturally, the good prophets were outraged by this. They had created, according to the legend, a perfect universe, but once those things came out of the temple, they became mortal and thus evil, even though it was accidental. Ironically, the legend has the prophecy of a flesh and blood Savior